Chapter 47, with the Newars in Nepal. The Newars of Nepal belonged to the same ethnic group as the Tibetans and the Burmese. Most of them lived in the Kathmandu Valley, which until the Gurkha conquests of the 18th century had been the seat of one or more independent Buddhist kingdoms. And despite pressure, not to say persecution, on the part of the state religion, Hinduism, most were still Buddhists. Apart from the Vajracharyas, the hereditary tantric priests, the majority of high-caste Newars were either craftsmen or traders, and though the bulk of the Newar population was concentrated in and around Kathmandu itself, as well as in Patan, small Newar communities existed in many parts of the country, wherever, in fact, there was the possibility of trade. During the previous decade, several Newars had gone to Ceylon and Burma to study the Pali scriptures and be ordained there, and at least one Theravadin Buddhist monk from Ceylon had visited Nepal. A minor revival of Buddhism was, in fact, in progress among them. This revival was not unconnected with the political aspirations of the Newars, who felt themselves to be a subject people in their own homeland. It was therefore regarded with grave suspicion by the Rana despotism, which, about a century earlier, had usurped the royal authority and now governed the country with harsh efficiency. When Yu Chandramani asked us to go and preach the Dharma to his disciples in Bhutan and Tanzen, he knew exactly what he was doing. These disciples were Newars, and the presence among them of two foreign monks would undoubtedly encourage them in their efforts to preserve their religious and cultural identity. At the same time, the experience would be of great value to Buddharakshita and myself. In Kusinara, all our contacts had been with bhikkhus and anagarikas. Now that we were with the Newars of Nepal, we would be meeting ordinary lay members of the spiritual community. And besides preaching the Dharma to them, we would be acquainting ourselves with the traditional observances and the etiquette customarily observed between monks and lay people. We were soon made to realize how inexperienced we were and how much we had to learn, even on the most elementary level. One of the rusty roofs we had seen belonged to the Padmagaba Vihara, and it was to this tiny outpost of Buddhism that, on our arrival at Bhutal, we had made our way, and where we had been put up for the night. Early next morning, just after we had completed our devotions, we were surprised by the arrival of 8 or 10 Newar women of various ages, all swathed in voluminous white muslin saris, and with rows of tiny gold rings glittering in the rims of their ears. Since they spoke very little Hindi, and we did not understand Newari, which was a monosyllabic language unrelated to any Indian tongue, we could not at first make out what they wanted. Eventually, however, after much laughing and giggling on their part, and a certain amount of cross-examination on ours, it transpired that they had come to take the 3 refuges and 5 precepts from us in the traditional ceremonial manner. This put us in a quandary. Though we had learned the salutation to the 3 jewels in Kusinara and recited it every day, we had not as yet been called upon to administer the refuges and precepts to anyone. What were we to do? After a quick consultation, we decided that the best course for us to take would be perfect frankness. Through one of the older women, who understood a little more Hindi than the rest, Buddharakshita therefore explained that we were newly ordained and had no experience of performing ceremonies, but that, if they had no objection, he would read out the appropriate Pali formulas from the book. They had no objection at all. In fact, they were touched by our frankness and overjoyed at having the opportunity of taking the refuges and precepts. And it was with smiles of satisfaction that they settled down on their knees, joined their hands together, closed their eyes, and prepared, with every evidence of devotion, to intone the sacred words of the responses after my friend. Being a Brahmin by birth and accustomed to chanting in Sanskrit from an early age, Buddharakshita had no difficulty in playing his part in the proceedings, which were therefore gone through without a hitch and terminated amidst general satisfaction. During the next 6 weeks we spent in Nepal, one or the other of us was called upon to administer the refuges and precepts at least once a day, so that we soon became proficient in this simple but basic ceremony, and able to perform it without reference to the book. On our first day in Bhutal, some of the women who had taken the refuges and precepts brought our pre-midday meal to us at the Vihara. On the second day, by general request, we went with our begging bowls to all the Newar houses in the neighbourhood. We had made known our intention of leaving for Palpatansan early next morning, and everybody wanted to have an opportunity of making merit by feeding us before we went. Since it was known beforehand that we were coming, there were none of the difficulties that we had to face in our quest for alms in the villages through which we had passed after leaving Kusinara. Conducted as we were from house to house by a small procession of men and boys, our going for alms was in fact not so much a begging round as a triumphal progress for the collection of the offerings of the faithful. At every one of the 10 or 12 houses to which we were led, we found the white-clad women waiting for us on their doorsteps with rice, vegetable curries, lentil soup, curds, milk, sweetmeats and pickles in such generous quantities that in a very short time our two bowls were filled to the very brim. Judging from the joy with which they received us and the devotion with which they made their offerings, it was a new experience for them to give alms in this way, and one which they deeply appreciated. Though the handful of Newar monks who had been trained in Ceylon had introduced a number of Theravadin customs, they had not, it seemed, as yet introduced the alms round. On returning to the Padmagarbha Vihara, we emptied our bowls of more than half their contents and distributed this quantity among the young people present as prasad. Even so, we were unable to finish what was left, with the result that for once in their miserable lives, the lean, mange-ridden curs that skulked in the neighbourhood of the Vihara enjoyed a good meal. Since we still went barefoot, we could not help noticing how filthy were the narrow, unpaved streets of the little town. There was no sanitation or garbage collection of any kind. Rubbish was simply thrown out of doors and windows into the street, where it rotted and decomposed in heaps, or was fought over by stray dogs. By lanes and alleys, in fact, any convenient wall, gutter, or patch of waste ground were evidently used as public latrines. Flies buzzed everywhere. Stench filled the air. Besides the lack of sanitation, there was, we found, an absence of some of the basic amenities of life. There was no hospital and no school. When we went out for a walk in the evening, a room in a ramshackle wooden building was pointed out to us. This was the library, we were told. Rather, it had been the library. After functioning for only 3 months, it had been closed down by the authorities and the founder arrested and imprisoned. Not without reason, perhaps, the government of Nepal believed that education fomented discontent. Potentially subversive institutions such as schools and libraries were therefore not encouraged. Despite the kindness with which we had been received, Buddharakshita and I were not sorry to abandon Bhutal for the cleaner air of the mountains. Though we left early, most of the Newar population not only came to the Vihara to see us off, but walked with us as far as the tree that marked the boundary of the town. At this tree we halted a few minutes, and with the exception of the two young men who were to accompany us to Tanzan, everybody bade us a friendly and affectionate farewell. We had not been climbing for more than an hour, and lungs and leg muscles had hardly begun to feel the strain, when something happened which not only interrupted our journey for that day, but suggested that the hardships of the last few months had not been without their effects on my health. Since 4 o'clock in the morning, I had been suffering from a pain in the stomach, a pain I had at first attributed to diarrhea, and it was now so severe that I was hardly able to walk. Massage brought only temporary relief, and after we had passed on again for half an hour, the pain returned with such violence that, having vomited a number of times, I lay down at the side of the road, almost wishing I could die on the spot. With great difficulty, Buddharakshita and our two young companions got me to a hut a few hundred yards further on, where I lay exhausted on the veranda. For the next 2 or 3 hours, the pain not only continued without respite, but grew steadily worse. Luckily, a man who happened to pass by suggested that the juice of a certain root would cure me of the complaint, and the old woman who lived in the hut was good enough to go off into the jungle and get it. The juice of that root was the bitterest thing I had ever tasted. After I had drunk it, however, the pain gradually subsided, and I sank into a deep and refreshing slumber. When I awoke 2 hours later, I found that the pain had disappeared, and after fortifying ourselves with Tibetan buttered tea, the first I had tasted, the four of us continued on our journey. Whether because surcease of pain made me feel more alive, or because of the invigorating effect of the mountain air, I not only stepped out as smartly as the rest, but started looking about me with fresh interest. Since my visit to Darjeeling 3 years earlier, I had seen nothing so magnificent as the scenery through which we were now passing. On our right, overhanging the stony track that girdled the base of the mountain, towered an enormous mass of rock, and down its precipitous face, streams of water were pouring in a number of places, and even cascading across the path. On our left, far below, raced the pale green, foaming waters of the river, which roared so loudly along their boulder-strewn course that at times we could hardly hear ourselves speak. After crossing a plank suspension bridge and traversing a pleasant valley, we found our way up to the shoulder of the next range of foothills and continued climbing steadily for nearly 4 hours. All around us, tier upon tier, rose the steep, tree-clad slopes, and the sound of streams was continually in our ears. Apart from a fat woman being carried in a sling between two coolies, the only signs of human existence that we came across were the occasional wayside hovel and the small patches of cultivation that clung precariously to the hillside. The higher we climbed, the colder it grew. Mist swirled across our path and eventually became so thick that we could hardly see our way. Buddharakshita and I shivered in our thin cotton robes. As soon as we reached the top and entered the village of Mashyam, however, the mist started clearing and we could see the masses of red and purple dahlias glimmering through the slowly thinning clouds from window boxes on either side of the road. Since Mashyam marked the highest point of our journey, Buddharakshita and I at first thought of spending the night there, but the presence of a number of sepoys, as well as a well-armed party of bandits, made us change our mind. Besides, our two young friends assured us that Tenzin was not very far away, and that we could easily reach it that night. When they had consumed the usual enormous heaps of rice and curry, and had prepared some sherbet for us, though we had missed our pre-midday meal owing to the pain in my stomach, as shramaneras, my friend and I could not eat after 12 o'clock, and so would have to fast until the morning. Our little party therefore made haste to leave Mashyam, and after walking a short distance, started descending into the valley below. Although the upward climb had been difficult enough, the subsequent downward scramble proved to be harder still. Moreover, night fell more quickly than we had expected, and the small electric torches of our companions were of little avail against the almost total darkness by which we were soon engulfed. For about 2 hours we groped our way along dangerous ledges, down precipitous slopes, and round awkward bends, with loose stones constantly slipping and rolling beneath our feet, and the sheer drop into the stream below uncomfortably close. By the time we reached the village of Damrai, Bularakshita and I were so exhausted that we decided to spend the night in a newer house there. The night was far from peaceful. At about 10 o'clock, the pain in my stomach returned, and since the whole place was in darkness, making it difficult to extract the juice from the old woman's root, my friend gave me a piece to chew. It was so bitter that I vomited. Bularakshita therefore went and begged some water from the next house, which was situated several dozen yards further down the cliff, almost immediately below us, and where, judging from the sounds that floated up to us through the cold night air, a party was in progress. On his return, Bularakshita reported in tones of the deepest disgust that the place was full of prostitutes, prostitute being, in his vocabulary, any woman not conforming to the strictest Hindu notions of feminine propriety. Despite the darkness, he somehow managed to crush the root between two stones, and after mixing the juice so obtained with a little of the water he had begged, gave it to me to drink. This time it was not very effective, and it was 2 o'clock before the pain had subsided sufficiently for me to be able to sleep. Next morning we left Damrai as soon as it was light, and after a pleasant walk through well-cultivated valleys, came to the outermost bastions of the next range of mountains, and started on the stiff climb up to Tanzan. Having eaten nothing for 2 days, we felt a little weak, and frequent rests were necessary. Moreover, the sun was now high in the sky, and shone so hotly that we were soon drenched in perspiration. Fortunately, the pain in my stomach was no more than a dull ache, and for this, at least, I was thankful. At about 9 o'clock we reached, at last, Tanzan, and went straight to the Ananda Vihara, where we were warmly welcomed by the Venerable Shakyananda, the resident monk, who immediately offered us tea, sweetmeats, and fruit. After the unexpected difficulties of the journey, we were glad to have reached our destination, and to have the opportunity of meeting one of the more senior disciples of Yu Chandramani. We were also glad to be within reach of medical aid. Such aid was, in fact, soon forthcoming. Shortly after our arrival, a Vaidya, or indigenous physician, happened to visit the Vihara, and on our explaining to him the nature of my complaint, he said that it was due to lack of nourishment, and advised me to keep the stomach filled. Though I had no appetite, I therefore ate something, and after sleeping for an hour or two, felt much better. In the afternoon, when Bularakshita and I were both sufficiently rested, we climbed through a maze of narrow cobbled stone streets to the Maha Chaitya Vihara, situated at the upper end of the town, where it had been settled we should stay. Like the Padmagarbha Vihara and the Ananda Vihara, this was no more than a narrow oblong chamber, with an image table at the far end between two cupboards. In one important respect, however, the Maha Chaitya Vihara differed from the other viharas. Outside, in the middle of the courtyard, stood a chaitya, or stupa, 7 or 8 feet in height. This whitewashed monument with the brass finial, after which the vihara was named, was not the modern Theravadin type, as might have been expected, but a genuine product of traditional Nepalese Buddhism. From the image table inside the vihara, the Ceylon and Burma-trained revivalists had banished all the Buddhas except the historical Shakyamuni, to say nothing of all the Bodhisattvas. But outside, from their niches in the four sides of the chaitya, the transcendental Buddhas, Amoghasiddhi or unobstructed success, Ratnasambhava, the jewel-born one, Akshobhya, the imperturbable, and Amitabha, the infinite light, still looked out upon the four quarters of space, Varochana, the illuminator, the Buddha of the centre, being hidden within the body of the monument. In the absence of a resident monk, care of the vihara had been entrusted to Anagarika Sushila, a tiny, intense woman, neither young nor old, with a cropped turnip head and rows of tiny holes in the rims of her rather prominent ears. She and the other Niwa Buddhists of the neighbourhood gave us an even warmer welcome than the one we had received at the Ananda Vihara, and after we had sat talking with them for an hour or two, they took us to see the lending library that had been established nearby. We were still looking at the 200-odd volumes when the pain in my stomach returned, and in the course of the evening became increasingly severe. Fortunately, medical aid was again forthcoming. Among the people who came to see us was a Calcutta-trained Bengali doctor. According to him, what I was suffering from was not lack of nourishment, but something much more serious. It was what the local people called ganor, he said. Ganor was a ball of wind that formed in the intestines as a result of drinking the hard mountain water, and it was extremely difficult to dislodge. He would get a mixture made up for me, and after fasting completely for 24 hours, I should take it 3 times a day until I was cured. Though I took the mixture as directed, it was more than a fortnight before the ball of wind was dispersed, and I was entirely free from pain. Moreover, to make matters worse, before I had been cured of one complaint, I developed another. A painful ulcer appeared on my right foot, which not only made it difficult for me to walk, but required daily dressing. What with the gunor and the ulcer, it was not easy for me to get about, and though Buddha Akshita was often out visiting, I therefore spent practically all my time at the vihara. In less than half a week, we had slipped into the placid routine of the orthodox Theravadin monk, and the ceremonious rhythm of our days was broken only by the larger rhythms of the recurrent lunar festivals. Rising at dawn, we chanted the praises of the three jewels and sat for a while in meditation. As soon as it was fully light, the more devout Niwa women and girls would assemble, and one of us would administer the revetes and precepts. This was followed by the ceremonial worship of the Buddha, after which the women came forward one by one and measured out in front of each of us, in turn, a small portion of unmilled rice. What with the triple prostrations on their part and repeated blessings on ours, this part of the proceedings lasted nearly an hour, and it was often quite late before Buddha Akshita and I were able to have breakfast. Moreover, the women did not always come together, and on some mornings we had to administer the refuges and precepts 2 or 3 times. We also discovered that in Nepal it was possible to perform one's devotions without entering the vihara. Suddenly, as we were sitting there, a handful of rice and small change would come flying through the air, narrowly missing us, and land with a crash on the image table. Sometimes it would hit the Buddha full in the face. Looking up, we would see through the door a stout, white-clad figure with a small basket under her arm, hurrying off to the next place of worship. Apparently, it was an old Niwa custom to make an early morning round of all the temples, viharas, and wayside shrines in the neighbourhood, worshipping at each one, and a busy housewife did not have much time to spare. The 2 or 3 hours after breakfast were generally spent in study. At 11 o'clock came lunch. For the first 2 or 3 days, this was provided by one or another of the Niwa families living in the neighbourhood. But in a society as caste-ridden as that of Nepal, anything even remotely connected with food and drink was bound to give rise to difficulties. Hindu neighbours noticed that the Niwa women not only took cooked food to the 2 foreign monks at the vihara, but brought the dirty dishes home after they had eaten and washed them. Since one of the monks was evidently a Mleka, a man from across the black water, this involved instant pollution, not only for the women themselves, but for all who came into contact with them, and the neighbours therefore threatened to report the matter to the police. This was no idle threat. In Nepal, the caste system had the force of law, and any infringement of its provisions was punishable by a fine or imprisonment or both. It was therefore arranged that in future we should have our lunch in Anagarika Sushila's schoolroom, which was only a few doors away. She was a nun, declared the intrepid little woman, and so far as she was concerned, caste restrictions did not apply to her. In any case, law or no law, no power on earth was going to stop her doing her duty by the monks of her own religion. At 11 o'clock every morning, we therefore made our way to the big upstairs room, where, with the assistance of another Anagarika, Sushila taught 2 or 3 dozen Newar girls of various ages, and where she also lived. As a result of these visits, we got to know her quite well. Buddha Rakshita, indeed, was soon making fun of the way in which she spoke Hindi, with the boisterous jocularity that was his nearest approach to humour. Her principal fault, in the eyes of the purist, lay in the fact that, when referring to her own actions, she often forgot to inflect her verbs according to the sex of the speaker. This fault Buddha Rakshita was constantly correcting. She spoke Hindi as though she was a man, he told her, which was most improper. One day, with a flash of impatience, she told him she was tired of all this business of masculine and feminine. Since she was a nun and was supposed to have discarded worldly conventions, she didn't think it mattered much whether she spoke like a man or like a woman. On another occasion, she told us what had led her to become an Anagarika. She had had a younger brother, of whom she was extremely fond. This brother had died suddenly. For a long time she could not put the thought of him out of her mind. Then, one night, when she was meditating, she saw him as a skeleton, white and shining, and all attachment had at once disappeared. Realizing that worldly things were impermanent, she had decided to devote herself to the spiritual life. And we had ceremonially given thanks to Sushila and her assistant for our meal. We returned to the Vihara, and after a brief rest, settled down to our studies again. Since it was the hottest, the afternoon was also the quietest time of day, and we could usually count on not being disturbed for at least 4 or 5 hours. While Buddha Rakshita ploughed his way through Hindi translations of the Pali Canon, I renewed my acquaintance with some sayings of the Buddha. I also did a little writing, and besides maintaining the journal I had been keeping since our departure from Benares, worked on first translations of the hymn Salutation to the Three Jewels and the 5 most popular Paritrana Sutras, or canonical texts recited as a means of blessing and protection. At 5 or 6 o'clock, someone would bring us a cup of tea, and people would start assembling for the evening worship. Buddha Rakshita and I laid aside our books and engaged in conversation. From a Western point of view, the atmosphere was a curious blend of the religious and the domestic, the formal and the familiar. Buddha Rakshita and I sat cross-legged on either side of the image table, on the pallets where we slept at night, and where we meditated. In front of us on the floor were the empty teacups. Men, women and children, practically all of them Newars, arrived singly and in small family groups. Some busied themselves at the image table, arranging the big purple, crimson and yellow dahlias, and lighting little paper twists of acridly sweet incense. Others sat quietly chatting. All, on their arrival, saluted each of us in turn with the traditional threefold prostration. Children seemed to take a particular delight in doing this properly. Babies had their heads bumped on the floor at our feet, which sometimes made them cry. When everybody had assembled, or when the flow of new arrivals seemed to have stopped, and when all those who wanted to talk to us had done so, candles would be lit and the worship begun. On special occasions, such as the full moon and new moon days, and the eights of the waxing and waning halves of the lunar month, the men devotees would gather in force, and devotional songs would continue far into the night. Some of these songs were of great beauty, and though for sheer emotional appeal they far surpassed anything I had heard in India, the note of hysterical abandon which had so repelled me at Anandamayi's ashram was completely lacking. Consequently, despite the fact that, according to the most rigid Theravadin interpretation of the precepts, the enjoyment of music, even devotional music, was forbidden to monks, I never tired of listening to the rising and falling of the great wave of melody that carried one, in a mood of serene ecstasy, nearer and ever nearer to the shining lotus feet of the Buddha. Devout Mullahs were by no means the only people who came to the Vihara. Apart from the Bengali doctor and the Bihari headmaster of the local high school, both of whom were frequent visitors, there was the town's second doctor, also Calcutta-trained, a plump, energetic Nepalese of the Malla caste, who, despite his Western education and his comparative youth, still wore the traditional Mughal-type dress of the country. His ancestors had been Buddhists, he told us, and he was descended from the Mallas of the Pali scriptures, who had been among the most faithful of the Buddha's followers, and in whose territory the master had died. In the Middle Ages, his family had ruled Nepal. Besides having a dispensary in town, he was physician in ordinary to the commander-in-chief, whom he saw every day. The commander-in-chief was not well enough to see us personally, it seemed, but we gathered from Dr. Mala that he knew of our arrival and had no objection to our staying at the Vihara as long as we wished. This was welcome news. Usually foreigners were not allowed to stay more than 3 days in one place, and in any case we had entered the country without official permission. Unfortunately, the Commander-in-Chief's goodwill seemed to take rather a long time to permeate the lower levels of the administration, and we continued to see at the Vihara a number of visitors of a less welcome type. These were the various plainclothes police agents, whom, ever since our arrival, we had noticed reclining against the wall, their looks of undisguised suspicion contrasting oddly with the reverential demeanour of the newers. Two of them, in fact, took the trouble of coming several times a day. Only much later, after the overthrow of the Rana regime, did I learn that the commander-in-chief himself was at that time an object of suspicion to the authorities in Kathmandu, and that an assistant commander-in-chief had been appointed to keep an eye on him. One evening, an incident occurred which shed further light on conditions in Nepal. Happening to look up from his book, Buddha Akshita saw a man standing outside the Vihara door, and in his usual imperious manner, at once invited him in. At first the man refused, but on my friend's insistence he eventually sidled diffidently into the room, clasping his cap to his chest with both hands. He was a tailor, and according to the laws of Nepal, all those who followed what orthodox Hinduism regarded as low-caste occupations were prohibited from entering any place of worship or public assembly. This meant that a Buddhist goldsmith, or a Buddhist tailor, for example, was unable to enter the viharas and temples of his own faith. Venerable Shakyananda, who was sitting with us at the time, told us that when a low-caste Buddhist woman had wanted to take the refuges and precepts from him, he had had to perform the ceremony outside the vihara, as she was not allowed inside. Later on, we had several more opportunities of observing the workings of the caste system in Nepal. For about a week, a party of some 20 uniformed police were bivouacked in the Vihara courtyard. On the night of their arrival, Buddha Akshita and I, looking out of the window, saw a dozen different cooking fires burning. There were a dozen different castes in the contingent, we were informed, and all of them cooked and ate separately from the rest. Some nights, however, we saw only two cooking fires, What had happened to everybody's caste, we wondered. One of the Niwar devotees cleared up the mystery for us. On previous nights, the policemen had cooked rice. Tonight they were cooking roti or unleavened bread. There was caste in rice, but not in roti. Not long afterwards, we received a still more bizarre reminder of how the caste system functioned in the, quote, land of the four colours and the 32 castes, unquote. In the early hours of the morning, we found a man of Gurung or Maga caste on the Vihara doorstep in a state of great distress. On his way back from Bhutal, he had been taken seriously ill and had been confined to bed for 3 days at an inn. One of his travelling companions, a man of much lower caste, had stayed behind and looked after him, while the rest of the party went on. Since he had eaten food cooked by this man, he had forfeited his caste, and his wife, fearful of pollution, refused to allow him into the house. Could he stay at the Vihara for a few hours? As soon as the police station was opened, he would go and tell them what had happened, pay the necessary fine, and obtain a certificate stating that he had regained his caste. He would then be able to go home to his wife. The description of Nepal as the land of the four colours and 32 castes we found in Part 5 of the Laws of Nepal. This part, which had been published some years before, during the prime ministership of Maharaja Yudha Shumshiri Junga Bahadur Rana, contained the laws governing religion. Since it was written in Nepali, or Gurkhali, neither my friend nor I was able to read it, but the young man who had brought it along for us to look at provided a running translation of some of the more crucial sections. Like the laws of Manu, on which it was probably based, it enumerated the different hereditary castes and subcastes, defined their respective duties, and regulated, not to say restricted, social intercourse between them, paying particular attention to who could touch or not touch, eat or not eat, marry or not marry, with whom. Penalties for infringements of the code were also prescribed, some of them harsh in the extreme. As in India, the whole system weighed most heavily and oppressively on the lower castes. Besides being unable to intermarry and interdine with those of higher caste, which may not have been a very great hardship, they were also denied admittance to temples and schools. What was more serious still, perhaps, they were prohibited from opening a shop or from engaging in any form of business, which, in a country where trade was the only means of acquiring wealth, meant they were denied all means of bettering themselves economically. Power of every kind, social, political, economic, religious, and intellectual, tended to be concentrated at the top of the pyramid, where, indeed, it was meant to be concentrated. In all this, there was nothing strange. Hindu Nepal was only following in the footsteps of Hindu India. What was strange was the way in which the Niwars and other Buddhist groups had been forcibly incorporated into the orthodox Hindu caste structure, and compelled, under the threat of fines, imprisonment, or even death, to conform to a system that was in direct opposition to the tenets of their own religion. No criticism of the established order was permitted. Only 2 or 3 years ago, so Venerable Shakyananda told us, one of the Ceylon-returned monks had been flogged by the then Prime Minister with his own hands for daring to say that the caste system was incompatible with the teaching of the Buddha and ought not to be followed. Some of the laws of Nepal were clearly designed not only to force the Niwars into the rigid framework of orthodox Hindu society, but also to discourage the cultivation of the Niwari language and literature, and indeed to stamp out Buddhism itself altogether. Books, magazines and newspapers could not be published in the Niwari language without prior permission of the government, and usually this permission was withheld. While the conversion of Buddhists to Hinduism was permitted, even encouraged, a Buddhist monk who administered the refuges and precepts to a non-Buddhist could be sent to prison for 6 years or subjected to any other punishment, including capital punishment, as the Prime Minister thought fit. Moreover, no one could be ordained as a Buddhist monk in Nepal. Should a Nepalese subject receive ordination abroad, and should his parents report the matter to the government after his return, he would be forced to return to lay life and might be fined, imprisoned, or otherwise punished according to the wishes of the Prime Minister. With laws like these on the statute book, it was only to be expected that foreign monks who gave moral support to the Nyuas and preached the Dharma were not particularly welcome to the authorities. We had been in Tanzin for 2 weeks and were becoming accustomed to the ceremonious routine of our days, when we were suddenly summoned to the local office of the government of Nepal and questioned with regard to our intentions. Our original idea had been to go on pilgrimage to Muktinath, we explained, but owing to illness and to the onset of the rains, we had been forced to abandon this idea. As soon as the ulcer on my foot was sufficiently healed, we would be returning to India. This explanation was apparently considered satisfactory, and no further questions were asked. However, we were told that we would have to leave Tanzin within 2 or 3 days. After returning to the Vihara and discussing the situation with the devotees, we therefore decided to go and see the assistant commander-in-chief and ask for an extension. This gentleman was a Brahmin, and an orthodox one at that. In fact, he had the title of Purohit Guru, which meant that he was one of the main pillars of the ecclesiastical establishment and wielded a great deal of influence. Venerable Shakyananda and 2 or 3 of the devotees accompanied us to his house. After we had waited a considerable time, a message came. We should stand in the middle of the street, and the assistant commander-in-chief would speak to us from the 4th or 5th story veranda. In this godlike manner, apparently, Nepalese government officials were accustomed to interview members of the public. Tearing a leaf from my journal, I at once wrote a note. According to Buddhist tradition, I said, it was not proper for a monk to speak to a layman from a lower level. We must speak together on the same level or not at all. When Venerable Shakyananda and the devotees learned what I had written, they were aghast. Such effrontery would land us all in jail, they protested, and fled. However, the servant returned after a few minutes and asked us to come upstairs. In a room on the first floor, we found a thin, elderly man in a white dhoti and sacred thread, sitting on a mattress surrounded by a perfect horde of small children. It was the assistant commander-in-chief. As he did not salute us, we did not salute him, and as he did not ask us to sit down, we sat down without being asked. Whether because he was afraid of assassination or ritual pollution, or whether, what was most likely, because we had put him at a disadvantage by addressing him in English, which he understood but did not speak very well, the Purohit Guru seemed extraordinarily nervous and ill at ease. Our business was therefore soon concluded. When we had explained why we were in Tanzin, emphasized that we had no interest in politics, stressed our desire to return to India as soon as possible, and shown him my foot, he muttered something to the effect that it would be all right for us to stay in Tanzin until my ulcer had healed and I could walk properly, whereupon we thanked him for his kindness and left. Despite the success of our interview, Buddharakshita and I knew that we could not stay in Tanzin much longer. Indeed, we had no real wish to stay. The rainy season had begun, and though as novices we were not obliged to observe the rain's residence, that was incumbent on all fully ordained bhikkhus, having preached the Dharma to Yu Trandramani's disciples as best we could, we were now eager to return to India and find a place where it would be possible for us to go into retreat for a few months. The last 2 weeks of our stay passed more rapidly than the first. Now that the ulcer was healing and I could walk more easily, our time tended to be divided between the Maha Chaitya Vihara at the top end of the town and the Ananda Vihara at the bottom, and the accelerated rhythm of our days included sermons and celebrations at both places. One afternoon, after a new moon day function at the Ananda Vihara, we set off with a party of devotees and scaled the heights behind Tanzin. Though it was a stiff climb, and though Buddharakshita and I were perspiring freely when we reached the top, the view that met our eyes would have made far greater efforts worthwhile. Brilliantly white against the blueness of the sky, the gigantic masses of the Himalayas rose in the distance before us, sheer and awful as the walls of heaven. Through the smoke-blue valleys at their feet drifted flock upon flock of small white clouds. One of our companions, more knowledgeable than the rest, pointed out some of the principal peaks. To the west was Dholagiri, to the east Annapurna, while in between, almost due north from Tanzin, rose a peak the Nepalese name of which meant fishtail. For a time we stood motionless, conscious of nothing but the silent sublimity of those immaculate heights, and the coolness of the breeze that blew straight down from them onto our perspiring bodies. Then our attention was diverted to things near at hand. On an eminence to the east huddled a small group of buildings. They had mud walls and roofs of thatch, and were completely encircled by a rough stone perimeter wall. This was Srinagar, whispered the devotees, the residence of the commander-in-chief. To me it looked more like a Stone Age fort than the home of one of the most powerful men in Nepal. Though there must have been quite a number of people inside, there was no sign of life whatever. As we already knew, the commander-in-chief lived in virtual isolation. He never went out, and except for Dr. Muller, who seemed to act as a kind of intermediary, nobody from the town ever came to see him. As I looked across at the little hilltop settlement, I could not help feeling that its quietness was the quietness of those who watch, and its inactivity the inactivity of those who hold themselves in readiness for an attack. A day or two later we left Tanzin. Several dozen people, including Venerable Shakyananda and the two Anagarikas, accompanied us down into the valley as far as a small wayside shop, where the last photographs were taken and where we said goodbye. Though we had spent only 4 weeks in their town, everybody seemed to be deeply affected by the parting, and as they rose to their feet after making their final prostrations, or pressed into our hands small packets of sugar candy, many of the devotees wept. Wanderers though we were, we felt sorry to be bidding farewell to so much love and devotion. The journey back to Bhutal passed without incident, or rather it passed without incident until we were within a mile of our destination. At this point, the light drizzle which we had encountered on our way down from Mashyam turned into heavy rain, and we were forced to take refuge in a fisherman's hut. This hut not only overlooked, but actually overhung the river, which, swollen by the monsoon rains, was now roaring more loudly than ever. By nightfall, however, we were safe in Bhutal, and soon the same devotees who had seen us off 4 weeks earlier were busy making us comfortable at the Padmagaba Vihara.